Professor Meisfeld, so sorry to have lost you. So nice to have you back.
Thanks. No worries.
Now, I don't know if you heard, while you were disconnected and we were trying to get you back over the ether, we were talking a little bit about your curriculum vitae and the work you've done. And the interesting thing, we were only joking. I mean, yes, you've been knighted and we talked about it while you were off air, and it's not what people think. You didn't get a sword or a suit of armor, but it's in recognition of the work you've done. And one, we'd like you to help us understand. You wrote a book about domestic violence and international law. And I guess the interpretation or the jurisprudence, what is the connection? And to answer Simon's question, isn't that a long scenic route to go about combating domestic violence? Help us out.
Sure, they're great questions. There really is the sense that something so global, public, and distant could possibly be relevant to something that happens in the most intimate context.
Yes.
But there are multiple ways in which international law works. And one of the most important ways is norm setting and setting standards by which states are directed or with which states must comply. And all sorts of rights are protected in international law, including the right to be free from violence. The right to be free from violence, though, is not limited only to the public sphere. It's not limited only to prisoners of war. The argument that I made is functionally, people who are trapped in a violent situation in their domestic realm, in their intimate realm, experience the same type of violence, but also the same constraint on their freedom as people who are imprisoned, as people who are tortured in captivity. Because there are a number of factors that prevent particularly women from escaping those situations. Economic factors, factors relating to societal disapproval of them leaving, fear for themselves after they leave or for their children if they leave, and of course, most poignant of all, which is love and the hope that the abuser will stop the abuse. But the seminal point is that when she does leave, is the state there to respond proportionately to her need? And because international law governs states, it is in that way that the law is responsive to victims and survivors of domestic violence. Because we can't change human behavior. At least I don't think so. I think that as human beings, we will always be progressing and regressing in terms of our humanity. But what we can change are the systems that respond to that behavior. We can change and ensure that our systems that respond to an imperfect society, that those systems themselves are not imperfect.
Is that even remotely possible, given the fact that probably, I don't know what the figures are, a third of the world probably endorses the subjugation of women in terms of not allowing them passports without their husband's permission, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, that's precisely why I think international law is the a key element, not the key element, but a key element, because it does require compliance with states, with these norms. And there has been a shift for a very long time because of international law. If you look now in Saudi Arabia, women are allowed to drive, for example. There's a shift to women appearing in radio shows and running journalist or being in journalism itself. So in jurisdictions where women's rights have not yet developed. So it's small incremental approaches. I think that's the utility of international law. It's also got an incredibly important purpose in naming things. So I for the purposes of the book and in terms of international law, my argument is that what we're dealing with is not just domestic violence. We're dealing with something I call systemic intimate violence. It's part of a system. Mm-hmm. In much the same way as racism is part of a system. It's not perpetrated one person against another person only. It's in everything that is structured around us. And calling harm by the right name can have incredible power. We saw this, for example, with the phenomenon of enforced disappearances. When it first began as a concept in Argentina in the 70s, in the so-called Dirty War, people would be abducted, dissidents would be abducted by people in plain clothes, so they weren't the police. when families would go and ask at the prisons where they were, the prison officials would say there's nobody there. And nobody would take responsibility for where the dissident was, but only dissidents would start disappearing. So we didn't have any law at the time. It wasn't kidnapping. It wasn't because there was no ransom note. It wasn't arrest because there was no claim that the person had been arrested. It wasn't detention because there was no state acknowledgement that the person has been detained. So we had a vacuum in legal labeling. And that's when this notion of disappearing, enforced disappearances came from. The state was literally making you disappear. Now, why is it so important to name something? Well, because as soon as you have a name for it and understand what that thing is, you can start taking steps to respond to it. Sure. And in the case of enforced disappearances, over many, many decades, they eventually set up a committee, an international committee, whose membership is responsible for finding people. And they find hundreds of people every year enforced who have been disappeared throughout the world. And there's a similar approach with international law in respect.
I hope we have the line again. You there? Prof?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
No, yes. We can.
You were saying there's a similar concept or a similar evolution of a term around intimate partner violence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because if we think about intimate partner violence as an odd event that happens, as one person attacking another person or hurting another person as an anomaly, then yes, international law seems strange. But if we see the reality, which is that 50,000 women a year globally are murdered by their intimate partners. That's just over 136 women a day. And if you take the dreadful massacre in New Zealand at the mosques, that's 50 people a day. And the world reacted with the appropriate outrage and pain.
Yes.
And we're looking at 136 women every day. But the world is silent about it. And it's silent because we're not calling this by the right name. It's not just intimate partner violence. It's not a question of one person's relationship with another person only. It's about a system that allows it to go on and on and on because people can't get help, because the law doesn't assist. And that is what the work is designed to change.
Wow, it's a heavy topic, Professor. There's so many more questions I think we have here, and there's so many more things we'd like to talk about. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I'd like to ask you in closing, maybe on a slightly lighter note, do you have any message, any words of wisdom for us on Human Rights Day 2019?
Absolutely. And that is, every single one of us is part of the solution. Don't stop being angry about human rights violations, and every particular step, every particular piece of energy, even this particular show, is capable of being part of the solution.
What a wonderful message. Just thinking as you're speaking, I definitely want to get you on more regularly because what you have to say is so important and you do it in such a wonderfully articulate manner.
We need to unpack
manner.
It more, yeah.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And hopefully we'll be speaking to you sooner rather than later.
Wonderful. Thanks very much.